to the Rampant Discourse Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Essen, and I'm joined by Section 230 expert Travis Hudson and chief Facebook hater and privacy boy, Andrew Riley. And as if that introduction wasn't enough to give you a clue of what we're talking about, we're going to be discussing the recent mini uproar, I'd say, amongst Silicon Valley and people on the internet over how social media companies like Twitter and Facebook should be handling the tweets and posts from one Donald J. Trump, the president of the United States.
For 40-something% of the population, he's the president of the United States.
Yeah.
Everyone else is claiming he's not their president.
Hashtag not my president. Actually, isn't Obama even talking tonight? Or
is he?
I think he has some sort of address to the nation.
He's gotten very, very talky in the past couple of weeks, which is remarkable for, you know, ex-presidents. You know, you look at what George W. Bush did when he was no longer president and Obama came in. He stayed out of the limelight and went to great lengths to try and stay out of it. Now, obviously, Trump is not the standard either, so I can't really expect to hold Obama to the same standard when his follow-up is Trump. But we are where we are, and Obama is talking a lot, and Trump is also talking a lot on Twitter, which is the whole point.
And George W. Bush also released a statement, I believe, yesterday.
Yes, he's been also coming out now, so it's not like Obama's alone in this, but, you know, it's more direct, I'd say.
Right. And so for those who don't know, there's been, for a long time, there's been the various legal cases brewing over legal cases and just cases amongst companies like Twitter and Facebook over how to handle, maybe to quote The Sound of Music, how do you handle a problem like President Trump in terms of a person who routinely, and probably almost daily, will publish things that are divorced from the truth, let's just say, to be kind, or breaking various terms of service, glorification of violence, I believe, is one of the recent tweets that President Trump put out that Twitter decided to label as being suspect because of glorification of violence. There was some widower who had sent a letter to Jack Dorsey, the CEO of Twitter, urging him to please either block Trump or delete certain tweets that Trump had posted about some conspiracy theory, and I don't even fully understand. I don't follow Trump on Twitter, but some conspiracy theory about his wife's death that understandably is pretty hurtful to have that coming up all the time and having people pester him about that. And on the other side, Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, has been relatively staunch in his idea that they should not be fact-checking or censoring in any way or modifying in any way stuff revolving around President Trump. And a lot of this has been coming down to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which is something that probably most Americans don't know about. So, Chief Section 230 expert Travis, would you like to weigh in?
Well, I had actually never heard of Section 230 until all this came up, so labeling me the expert is probably no good.
Would you like me to read it out?
No, do not read it. It's legalese. It's awful.
Oh, no. It's the Section 230 is just 26 words. I mean, it's legalese, but it's
sure,
not that
long. Sure, read 26 words of legalese.
Okay. So Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act states, "No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider." It's been referred to as the 26 words that created the internet.
Yep.
Right. And it's basically, to make sure I understand it, that's basically the part that says you can't sue Facebook for something that somebody else, that somebody posted on Facebook. That's the long and short of it?
That's the current version of it. Where it comes from is obviously deeper into the past of the internet before things like Facebook and Twitter existed. You have ISPs asking for immunity from lawsuits for when they hosted stuff that was libelous or defamatory or, you know, pornographic. They didn't want to be receiving criticism or lawsuits for obscene material or potentially illegal material that their users were posting, and because they weren't providing any editorial oversight of the stuff that was actually being published. Everyone else could hold their own page, and they were responsible for the content. And that's why it's the 26 words that creates the internet, because without that kind of protection, it's requiring even companies like ISPs and now more obviously Facebook and Twitter to make editorial decisions as to whether or not this content is illegal and under what jurisdictions. You know, there's a U.S. federal jurisdiction, but these are also international companies. We're talking about a U.S. amendments here, but it's the same kind of idea. And if they are, if Section 230 is removed, then that, or never created more accurately, I'd say, then that dramatically changes the face of what goes on the internet. You don't have things like blogs that can pop up because there's always this pressure, this requirement, and this institutionalized aspect of it, which reduces the ability of people without proper license, and that means a process, to speak.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't, to your point, it's not just these huge multinational corporations that maybe can afford to hire legions of people to look over all the tweets and Facebook posts, but it applies to something like our own, like blogs and our own website, rampantdiscourse.com, where you have people publishing posts, third parties coming in and commenting on articles. Without Section 230, we could be liable for if someone went on there and said and posted some sort of libelous thing or a threat or whatever it is, we would be held responsible as a publisher of that material. But because of Section 230, we are not considered a publisher.
And how
deep? We are a publisher, but for only our own content.
Yes, correct.
The person who comes and makes a comment on one of our articles, if that comment had that kind of material, yes, then we would have that protection, which is a distinction because obviously we are publishers in the content that we need to produce ourselves. If one of us writes a libelous article, then we are suspect to that libel lawsuit.
My money is on Andrew.
How far up the chain does it kind of go, though? Because you guys were talking about, you know, ISPs and all that. Like, you know, Rampant Discourse is hosted by something, and then people get it through their ISP and things like that. Like, it's kind of hard to pin down, like, who actually kind of owns a piece of digital information in that regard, right? Like we,
there's a lot of fingers in this pie.
Because we put it through we put it through WordPress. So, like, does WordPress responsible? Is Bluehost or whatever we use responsible? Like I don't know, on and on.
And even if they're not responsible, what, you know, moral responsibility do we put on these corporations to do these things? There was a lot of pressure, and in fact, I forget the name of the ISP, but there was an ISP that finally broke down and said, "No, okay, we give in to the pressure, and we will no longer host the neo-Nazi website Stormfront." So this is a thing that is happening even with Section 230 protections, that there's sufficient pressure to say, okay, guys, we need to do something about this because we don't want this kind of, or enough people don't want this kind of speech on the internet, even be accessible to anybody.
Right, and that's what we're seeing right now with Twitter and Facebook. Like, well, Trump is threatening government action against those companies, but probably he can't do anything. Because
probably
of Section 230.
He can't do anything. Not what? Just because of Section 230.
Well, sorry to cut it off, but like I was as much as I read about it, I was confused on what is he trying to get them to do? Because from what I read, that the company's pushback was if he was successful, they would be slapping more fact checks on more things and taking down more things. Like, they'd have to do more of it, not less of it. It seemed that's at least the articles I had read.
If Section 230 gets taken down, which is what would happen as a result of what Trump is talking about, then they become de facto, as well as and de jure, publishers rather than just being actually publishers right now. We'll come back to that in a second, because that's why I think Section 230 is kind of messed up with where we are right now. But right now, they are claiming to be a platform, and so they feel that not only do they not have the right, they don't, and responsibility, they're not going to be involved in these kinds of things where they're shutting down certain kinds of speech unless it's also against the terms of service for their service providing process, which means Twitter says you can't use Twitter unless you agree to these rules, because it's a very narrow thing. It's just Twitter. You can still say that on the internet. You can say that on your own website. You can say that on your own blog, as long as the ISP doesn't take you down. And they're probably not, because they pay much more attention to, you know, the freedom of speech aspects of the First Amendment versus their legal responsibilities under Section 230, and their, not just the responsibilities, but liabilities. That's the word I was looking for there. If President Trump succeeds, it probably does mean the death of Section 230, and that means the fact checking. The fact is, he is being prohibited from saying these things, not because of Section 230, but because of the terms and services of something like Twitter, which is not something that he has the right to control. But if he's saying basically it's this censorship thing, you know, Twitter doesn't have to follow the First Amendment. They're a private company. They have no responsibility to. They can say whatever they want about the terms of service. If he's saying you must open up, then he's going back to not just these people are platforms, but everything is a platform. He's completely changing and upending the process, and I don't think that that is very likely, just because it's outside the scope of what we've ever seen government do. But these are very different times than we've seen before as well, so I could definitely see something very strange happening here.
Well, I think I'm not even entirely sure what the process would be in terms of, would that be a court case, or would that go through like the FCC, or how would one go about? I mean, I guess in theory you would like it to go through Congress, but I feel like nothing goes through Congress these days anymore.
The normal process would be if I say something on Twitter that I feel I have a right to say and they shut me down, I would have to sue Twitter. So it would go through the court case. I would say, your terms of service are so extreme that I can't post my valid opinion about this important subject that I should be able to talk about. And the courts would say, too bad, it's a private company, they can do whatever they want. But if it were egregious enough, maybe I could get some sympathy from the court, and in some sort of bargaining system, they say, well, we're not going to punish this, but why don't you open it up a little bit more so that this becomes less of an issue for you in the future and you don't get these kinds of lawsuits. Because Trump is the president of the United States, he still has that option as a person, but he also has the entire executive branch at his command, which includes things like the FCC. And you have effectively the legislative branch having given over all control of aspects like this to things like the FCC through those organizations to try and actually make these changes. And that does mean that you're not going to see these things occurring in the legislation. You're not going to see a new law on the floor of Congress saying, here's how we should treat situations on the internet when it comes to inflammatory comments by public officials. It's just never going to happen. They don't want to do that. They don't want to hamstring themselves. They don't want to make that political gesture against their president, even though the Democrats probably don't want to do that. There's no benefit to them doing it in a legislative process, even though that may be what is ideally going to happen in that. I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing either, because if you remember back a year or two ago, we also had the Mark Zuckerberg testimony before the Senate, and it was a disaster because it was very clear that almost none of the senators had a clue about how the internet worked. They maybe are representatives and therefore should be representative of us, but they are representative in actuality of a much older population than the United States population at large, and they are out of touch with things that have happened in the past 30 or 40 years.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't even understand how Facebook made money, right? Like, that was like half of the questions was, how do you make money if you offer everything for free? And Zuckerberg was like, we show ads, which is obvious to anybody who uses Facebook.
Yeah, and I to some of those senators' defense, just to point out, because I do think that is being overplayed. The senators were asking that question not just to ask the question, well, tell me, how does this work? But to get him on the record as saying the way that Facebook makes money is it sells targeted ads to its users by giving information about its users to the advertisers. That is its business model. And by putting it on the record and making those questions very simple and very explicit, they forced him to, you know, answer a stupid question, but with the purpose of showing that that was the process and that is a problem. They didn't go in and do anything about it, but they were able to show, okay, this is how it works, and this is a problem, and it's on the record now. It ends up not doing anything. But yeah, it sort of looks like stupid questions. And there are plenty of them that were actually stupid questions. Like, can you come over and help me get Facebook working right on my phone? Those kinds of questions were coming out of them. So at the same time that I will defend some of them for having valid purpose, you only need to do that once. The next 20 senators in a row who ask the same question, you're right, Paul. Those were stupid questions.
I'm always right.
Even when you're wrong, you're partially right.
So going back about what would it actually do, even if they took away 230, Section 230, wouldn't Twitter still have the right to have their own terms of service and just do exactly what they were doing, right? I guess I'm trying to wrap my head around what Trump actually thinks he's trying to solve by tearing it tearing that down?
Well, I think the confusing thing is that there's a couple of different things at play here. One is Section 230 protects Twitter from being held responsible for what the people on it say. At the same time, as a private company, Twitter does actively censor. They have taken upon themselves, whether it's through for some moral purpose or whatever it is, they've taken upon themselves to remove certain tweets, like glorification of violence, whatever it is. There's a long list of them. And as part of that, there is this sense among some on the right that Twitter is purging conservative viewpoints. I know one thing, there's a large battle over a lot of transgender issues, like if you dead name somebody or whatever. There are a lot of things you can get banned or at least suspended from Twitter for espousing views that a lot of conservatives believe that a lot of leftists will think are offensive. And Twitter is a fairly leftist organization. Jack Dorsey is a fairly leftist person. I don't think I'm saying anything controversial here. So there's a sense amongst Republicans that Twitter is out to get them. And at the same time, there's a sense amongst a lot of Democrats, like, why do you let Trump get away with so much that nobody else on Twitter can get away with? And it's true. I mean, I think it's pretty undeniable that Trump routinely tweets things on a daily basis that any other user would probably get suspended for.
Right. I guess what I keep poking at, though, I guess, is why are they trying? Why would he try to take down Section 230 if that doesn't even solve the perceived problem, right?
I don't think that the issue is that he wants to take down Section 230. For one thing, I'm not entirely sure that President Trump knows what Section 230 is.
True.
I would say what he wants to do is he wants to create a new law or empower his agencies to act upon his desires to force the companies to allow him to say whatever he wants. But by doing that, he is going to cause a situation where Section 230 becomes essentially null and void. It may still technically be on the books, but it would no longer be enforceable because this other thing would override it.
So by trying to fix the problem, you create an even worse problem in some ways.
Yes, that's Section 230 in a nutshell. The problem that Section 230 fixed was, you know, you couldn't have people posting anything on the internet because there was too much concern about things being shut down, so no one was allowed to. So you fix it and you open it up, and well, that creates all these other problems where people start posting stuff that we don't want on the internet, and so we start trying to minimize that and say, here are our terms and services and stuff. It's a constant battle because we're talking about basically trying to legislate human nature. I would say on Twitter, to get back to that for a second, though, I think Twitter also has a difficult position because my understanding is that President Trump tweets under two accounts. He tweets as Real Donald J. Trump, which is his personal account for the man who happens to be president. But he also tweets under the President of the United States Twitter account, which is a account that transfers with the transfer of the office, right? Primarily, he's tweeting under his personal account.
Yeah, I think most of the stuff he tweets is from his personal account.
Right. I would say that Twitter has a lot more legal ground to very more stringently censor, for lack of a better word, his personal account, because he's just a person. Yeah, he's the president. Yes, it's important. But he is a guy who happens to have this office. If they were to try and censor the official account, that would be more problematic for them, I think, in a legal sense. But the thing is, Trump isn't posting his incendiary stuff off the official account. He's doing it on his personal account.
Yeah, and I believe there's also a court case about whether the official presidential account can block people on Twitter. Because that's something that you can do. You can block people on Twitter so they can't see your tweets. And is that legal, basically, to have the official presidential Twitter account block you? Because sometimes he announces policy positions on Twitter before anyplace else.
Which, by the way, as a person who has lambasted the idea of something like a homeowners association making a policy decision on Facebook, the president of the United States making a policy decision on Twitter is equally bad.
So I have a fairly positive view on Section 230. And a lot of that comes from, there's a lot of groups people and groups that I follow on the internet, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a lot of libertarians who generally are in favor of a pretty open internet, and they believe that this is one of the vanguards of an open internet. Andrew, you sound a little more reserved in your positive feelings about it. And I'm wondering if I'm reading into that correctly or if there's something about it that you are concerned about.
That's a tough one. I don't think that you're reading anything into it. I think I am very much on board with the idea of Section 230. Section 230 is critically important for an internet. Not just any internet, but the internet we certainly have, but any internet at all could not exist without this because what's the difference? The difference between the internet with Section 230 and the internet without Section 230 is the same as the difference between the Central Park in New York City and the New York Times. Anybody can get up on a soapbox in Central Park and start saying anything.
That sounds awful. Right?
But that's true. That's how it works. That's also how the internet works. Anybody can get up saying anything. And yeah, sometimes that's awful. Sometimes they start spouting off stuff that is really offensive. And maybe they shouldn't be saying that. And maybe they're causing a problem. And maybe the police come and arrest this person. But then there's a reason for it other than just, you're not allowed to say that. The New York Times, when they publish things, it's publishing. It's being made, and it's under their umbrella as the New York Times. And it's not just their reputation at stake, but they are held to a higher standard. You know, they were required to ensure that the speech that they have meets certain standards. The guy in Central Park doesn't have the same kind of decency standards. He can start swearing. If he starts swearing a lot, the cops are probably going to come and get him. But if the New York Times starts publishing a bunch of swears, they are potentially liable under obscenity laws. Now, the world we live in, that's not going to happen anymore. But there was a time when that certainly could have happened. So the publication, publisher versus not publisher, and platform. And when you think about platforms, think about soapbox. The soapbox is the platform.
Or the town square, I think, was the other metaphor I'd always heard about, right? Like,
right. It is for a town square. But I like the soapbox as both, you know, identifying what kind of crackpots are out there talking. But also, they're standing up on a platform that happens to be a soapbox. That platform is what is important for understanding the difference between those two things. Because if you're publishing things, you're taking a certain kind of ownership of it. Whereas with a platform, it's just a box.
Right. And I was wondering about, since both of you are libertarian, about it, shouldn't the free market kind of sort things out, right? Like the people that don't like what Trump is posting, like what, like you could just block Trump if you wanted to, if you don't want to see what he's saying. And then that just becomes even more divisive. But like, isn't people that think he's, that say he's lying, are going to say he's lying. People that believe him are going to believe, like, come stepping in and trying to censor anything, just as we've seen, just like exacerbates the issue. It doesn't, like, putting a fact check on anything didn't change anybody's mind about whether it was true or false, did it?
The benefits that it could have are, for certain kinds of things, it can minimize downstream damage. So if Trump really is posting a tweet that glorifies or incentivizes violence,
right,
and Twitter doesn't take it down, do we get violence as a result?
So, and I was treating that as a separate one, though, because like that you're potentially inciting something versus you're twisting a fact, I guess.
Right. But so Twitter will almost certainly never get onto Trump for lying, simply because there's no benefit to them. They're not going to go down that path. They want to, when they do stop him or minimize his tweets, reduce what he's saying that can cause harm. So one of the things, like, you know, the inciting violence or the chloroquine, when he does something like that, there's much more room for them to be involved, especially because they have been so aggressive in tweet management, you know, that they will edit tweets, essentially. They censor things. They say, you can't publish that here. So because they are already taking on some of the roles of a publisher and are less and less a pure platform, they have taken on some additional responsibilities, right, under something like Section 230. They no longer have the broad protection. So when he starts to say these things, that is where some of that comes back. Is he, because they are renouncing, although they will never admit that, their platform status, do they have a right and a responsibility to delete a tweet that is egregiously false?
So, okay.
I want to push back on one thing you said, Andrew, about whether they'll get on his case about lying or not. Because there was the tweet that Trump had where he said, there is no way, zero, that mail-in ballots will be anything less than substantially fraudulent. And with that tweet, Twitter actually, they left it up, but they did append the message saying, get the facts about the mail-in ballots, which linked to a page with the headline, Trump makes unsubstantiated claim that mail-in ballots will lead to voter fraud. So, yes, they left the tweet up, and they didn't directly contradict it, but they pretty much said, like, hey, here's some facts that directly contradict what he said.
But it's not even that it directly contradicts it. It's just, this is an unsubstantiated claim, which, of course, it is an unsubstantiated claim. Mm. It's also probably a true claim.
Mm. Which one's the true claim? Trump's claim or the...
Trump's claim that it will increase voter fraud is true. Mm. Mail-in ballots will have a higher rate of fraud than in-person balloting. Not by a lot and not by anything that is likely to matter. But if you are, you know, allowing ballots outside of the control of the government agencies and processes by which they are designed to be used, then people who have ill intent can abuse that.
Right. Yeah. No, I didn't want to pass judgment on the truthiness right. of the tweet, but more just Twitter.
Yes.
In my opinion, they've taken extra steps lately. They've always been the more active in terms of outright banning and suspending and censoring, but it seems like they're taking further steps as of late.
So
why that one? Why that post?
Well,
that tweet?
That's what I was just about to bring up. Like, you brought up the, I'm going to pronounce it wrong, the hydrochlorine or what's it called?
Oh, yeah. That medicine.
Hydroquinine. Yeah, I probably mispronounced that too.
Whatever that is. It's like,
derivative of quinine.
There was no fact check. But my point I was going to make is there's no fact checking on that, but. And again, this is like who you can block and who you choose to listen to in echo chambers and all that. Like, there was a avalanche of social media posts after that saying, please do not drink bleach. Please do not inject. Like, that's all I saw that day from like every like local organization, like from my fire department, the police department, the government, the hospital, like everybody was just countering it. So is that...
Don't stick marbles up your nose.
But like, I guess I'm wondering to... I don't know if this is devil's advocate or whose side I'm on this or something like that. Is it really Twitter's responsibility to do the policing rather than the other users of Twitter doing the policing?
Boom. Exactly. That is my big issue with this. And I'll take a definitive stand here. I used to be a shareholder in Twitter. And one of the main reasons I am not anymore is because I hate that they're getting into this job of trying to determine what is true and what is false and what should be allowed to be said and what shouldn't. And that's a great, that the whatever medicine, the cure that Trump touts for coronavirus is a great example, because there's another story where I believe YouTube said that they were going to start banning, blocking, censoring, whatever it is, any medical information regarding coronavirus that doesn't conform to the WHO established standards, which sounds good on the surface, except just like 1 month ago, 2 months ago, I'm not sure. It feels like it's been forever since we've been in lockdown. But pretty recently, the WHO was still saying, like, no, don't wear face masks. Mm-hmm. Like, not just like... they don't do any good, but like actively don't do it because they actually do more harm than good. And there are lots of other people out there saying, like, no, this is wrong. Like, plenty of Asian countries do it. It prevents the water droplets. There was a robust and legitimate debate going on. And if we were to be listening to YouTube here, they would be saying, no, the WHO says this. Everybody else is a crackpot. And they would have been wrong there. Well, presumably, maybe we'll find out in a couple of months that face masks actually are bad for you. Who knows? But the point is, like, I don't want... Google, YouTube, Twitter, Jack Dorsey, the WHO to be unilaterally determining what knowledge is worth sharing and what ideas are crackpot ideas that aren't worth sharing. Yes, Trump was wrong on this, and he's probably spectacularly wrong on the ultraviolet light and the bleach and everything else. But, and I don't want to necessarily say that he should have the right to say those things, because that's not the hill I want to die on necessarily. But I think there are plenty of also crackpotish sounding ideas that should be willing to be heard. You know, they could be right. People didn't think that people thought that eating fat was bad for you, and that we had to have these low fat, high carb diets. And we found out that was wrong. Like, things
for certain people. and people change, mm-hmm. and our diets change, and our understanding changes. And when we say we're going to listen to the experts, that's great, but experts are frequently wrong. They just happen to be the ones best informed to try and make a logical decision. I'll die on that hill, though. I'll say President Trump should be able to say whatever he wants as a person. I have concerns that when he says things, people take action. I have a great deal of concern about the amount of faith that people put into the leaders when they really, really shouldn't. No one should be listening to Trump and saying, oh, yeah, this man has all the answers, because no more than anyone else does he have all the answers.
Right. And I think that's why, I mean, that's on top of all the other reasons why the tweet about the looting starts, the shooting starts, whatever the exact quote is. Like, we saw people going to poison control over previous things he had said. So we know, we have proof that what he says leads to actions. And that's, yeah, that's a different beast than just saying what you want to say. But then he tries to couch it in like, oh, I was just kidding. Well, no, but the 2 billion people that just heard it yesterday didn't know you were, some of them didn't know you were kidding.
Yeah, you can never assume that your audience is smart. If you assume your audience is smart, you're going to be disappointed.
Yeah, but just how I don't want everyone like putting Trump on this pedestal, like he knows all and I should listen to whatever he does. I likewise don't want people to do that with Jack Dorsey or Mark Zuckerberg or whoever it is. I don't want some, especially Jack Dorsey. Oh my God, do you guys follow the weird crap that he does in terms of like only eating like one meal a day throughout the entire week and then like fasting all weekend or something, or taking ice baths? And he's a crazy dude.
He sounds like Tim Ferriss.
Yeah, I mean, he's out there, and you know, he's a great entrepreneur and everything, and probably a pretty good CEO. But man, I don't put a lot of faith in his ideas of what information we should be hearing, what information we shouldn't be hearing.
I think the word faith there is actually very important, because somebody in all these situations is putting faith into someone else. We're putting faith into Twitter to make the right decisions about what they will edit out of the discourse. We're putting faith in the president to not say stupid things to the public in a way that could be harmful to them. We're putting faith in our institutions and in our elites to have the right information and make the right decisions, when we know all of these things aren't always there. We're putting too much faith into other people and not trying to make the right decisions ourselves. And part of that is because we're dealing with very, very complicated things. We're dealing with a lot. We're dealing with very complicated situations right now, and a lot of them. And so to simplify things, we're looking for any kind of help that we can get. And we want to say, okay, just make it all go away. Make my life easier. Make the decisions for me so that I can get back to doing what I like to do, which is sitting down, watching television, and drinking a beer.
And listening to Rampant Discourse podcast.
But but the point is, though, that we need to think. We need people to be able to think, and we don't have a lot of critical thinking in general. And I think we've done ourselves a real disservice with that. But we're seeing the outcomes of it in these, and this, and the level of the discourse that we're having is really showing that all around. And yes, I'm going to say discourse a lot here, because that's the whole reason why I'm so invested in what we do. We need to elevate that by having solid discussions about it from every direction.
So, you know,
Paul and I are libertarians, but we are very different in our styles of libertarianism, very obviously. And Travis has a very different opinion from us as well.
Yeah, so just kind of popped in my head when you guys are talking about different experts, and obviously different sides put their faith in different experts. So like, how should we reconcile where one side's experts say, you need to wear face masks, you need to stay home, I'm sorry you lost your job, and the other side is saying, like, screw that, more people are going to die because of job loss and everything, you need to reopen everything up, and I don't want to wear your stinking face mask. Like, how do we reconcile when experts are so divided on something?
Well, so this won't exactly answer your question, but I'll throw out a bit of a controversial statement. I think the scientists, specifically the infectious disease experts like Dr. Fauci, so on and so forth, I think they should be listened to, but I also don't think that they should be the ones making the decision, because those that are closest to the diseases like coronavirus, I think they're going to naturally be biased towards this is a horrible disease. We need to do everything we can to contain it, to make sure it doesn't spread, so on and so forth. And I don't know if they can reasonably balance that with the incredible harm that's going to be done to the economy. They are not economists. You need somebody hopefully approach it with an open mind. And I don't have much faith that many politicians can do that, but hopefully approach it with an open mind and listen to the experts on both sides. Listen to the economists who are saying, like, you can have a shutdown for 1 month or 2 months, but then you're going to need such and such stimulus, or you're going to need to start having a phased reopening or whatever. And then you can listen to the infectious disease experts on the other side saying, like, you really, really have to have a 2 month lockdown, or, you know, you can't start the phased rollout until whatever. And even then, there's no guarantee. I mean, I don't know, Travis, if you're aware, but a lot of people like to talk about Sweden, because mm-hmm. Sweden has gone with a completely different approach, which a lot of people have already kind of jumped to conclusions that it's the failed approach. Like, look at the numbers. We've already proven they failed. But I think long term, the jury's still out, because the idea was you sacrifice people.
Right. You essentially sacrifice people now. They took the utilitarian approach, right?
You have a greater death count now, and that hopefully you'll have over the long term, five years out, it'll be less of a death count, because you'll develop that herd immunity.
And you haven't ruined your economics and all that.
And you haven't ruined your economy. And that could, you know, 5 years from now, we could all be, you probably won't see it in the newspapers. You know, you probably won't see any news stories about it saying Sweden had it right all along, but we could easily be looking at a situation where they did have it right all along. I don't know if that's the case or not, because I think Sweden's expert on the case has already said he's made some mistakes and maybe they had the wrong approach. But I don't think anybody knows what the right approach is right now. So I think it's a tough call.
Everyone has an idea that is informed by their experiences. So the epidemiologist is going to have the idea that the best way to combat this disease is with the lockdown. If you really want to stop this, you need to quarantine every person in their home for a month. Maybe 2 months, but at least a month. None of this, okay, you can go out to work if you're essential. No, everybody stays home. And then anybody who has the disease dies, or is likely to die. And anybody who doesn't have enough food in their house dies, and so on and so forth. So this is really bad. But as a numbers thing, that is the way that you have the fewest death by diseases. And overall, you probably have a lot fewer deaths in total. And then you have that contact tracing to make sure that anybody who is in contact with those people is locked down and doesn't have future contact as a carrier until we are sure that they don't have the disease anymore either. That is an epidemiological response that does work, but it causes massive systemic damage to the economy while also directly being responsible for the deaths of people through, you know, starvation in some cases. So that is something that is unacceptable as a policy, but it is an epidemiologically correct response.
And I think part of the problem is you have this almost, probably a bad term, but like black and white idea of you can't sacrifice a single person for the economy. And I'm using like scare quotes here that you podcast listeners can't really see. But that's kind of crazy to me. Like you can't have this mentality that like not one person can die of coronavirus in order to save the economy. Like in that case, like you would never let anyone out to drive a car because one person might die from a car accident. Or during flu season, you would have permanent lockdowns because people might die from the flu. There has to be a reasonable balancing of it. It sounds cold and cruel and callous, but you have to sacrifice a certain number of people to this disease for the greater good of the economy. And these are calculations that I believe the government does. They put values on human life in terms of, you know, do we raise the speed limit another 5 miles per hour and get this much economic benefit, but get, you know, lose this many hundreds of lives a year? Or for space flight, I think NASA runs these calculations as well. Like, do we add in an extra redundant backup system to reduce the chances of losing an astronaut by X percent? Like, these are trade-offs that real adults have to make in the real world. You can't just have this absolutist position of, you know, not a single death. We have to do whatever it takes. I've stunned everyone in the silence.
I'm having minor technical difficulties. I'll fix them.
Oh,
well. That's not right. I clicked a thing I shouldn't have clicked. I don't know why I did that.
Stop checking Donald J. Trump's Twitter feed.
So I guess one thing I wanted to pin you guys down on is, and we haven't directly addressed it really, although we've danced around the idea, is so Jack Dorsey seems to have this approach of curating the Guardian a little bit more and moderating the content and pointing out the mail-in ballot tweets and kind of purging or suspending and banning certain accounts. And Mark Zuckerberg has angered many of his employees and made some news over his steadfastness that no, we shouldn't be the arbiters of truth and labeling things as such on Facebook. And I think even today there was some articles about how one of their software engineers very publicly resigned in protest or something. And I guess to make it a binary choice, are you guys Team Jack or Team Zuck?
You're putting Andrew in a really tough spot there.
I know.
Travis looks like he's mulling it over.
Well, but I'm just thinking like it's like everything. It's too nuanced to make yes a true or false because Facebook does still disallow content. Like you can't put like pornography or other certain thing like because like right there's like there's countries there's countries that are employed of like these people have to look at all this horrific content before it goes up, right? So he's not saying they're not that they're not doing that, I guess is the right double negative. But like I do agree with his point then that they should not be labeling what is true and what is false. I guess is that your direct question you're pinning us down on?
Pretty much. Although you bring up a good point because after the election, I think Mark Zuckerberg was very public in his we have to crack down on this this fake news, these Russian attempts at interference, and we're going to have to like be taking a closer look at some of the ads that we run. And so I don't know. I guess he's not exactly the pure like free
he's
speech.
He's definitely not. Definitely not pure.
I know your opinions on Mark Zuckerberg, but in this particular issue, like I'm not holding him up as some sort of like Randian right. ideal man or something like that. He's not John Galt, but he's in contrast to Jack Dorsey, he would be, I think, the free speech hero? Question mark. Well,
I think my question earlier, I guess, is kind of my answer. Then is like, I would more leave it up to the popular vote, I guess, in a way, to like determine it. Like you can't come out there as the publisher of something and start decreeing what's true and what's not unless it's you saying it, I guess. Like they're perfect. He's perfectly fine. Zuckerberg himself then would be perfectly fine to post something like, I don't think this is true. Okay, that's fine. Mm-hmm. Even Facebook could post and say like that, but I don't know if it seems to be different when you actually go start mucking with that person, somebody else's content like that, I guess.
Which is the real question. Whose content is this, right? If it's the person's content, then they're still in the threshold of a platform. If it's Facebook's content, which it is, by the way, then they're a publisher. It's Facebook's content because they're selling it. They're selling every piece of that to you through the advertisers. So ultimately what it comes down to is, I would rather have Zuckerberg here as well. He is libertarian leaning in a lot of ways. He is very big on the First Amendment. He likes it. I do too. You can be a libertarian and evil. And I think that both things are true about Zuckerberg here. He's a libertarian, at least in this respect, and he's still doing evil things. And I don't expect a whole lot out of him, and he's not doing a whole lot. So good. I will say that Facebook does monitor the content on it to make sure that stuff that doesn't meet their terms of service and is illegal in the jurisdictions is not being posted. So they are doing a lot of that, and it's very hard work that they mistreat their employees on. We've had discussions about that already. But that stuff that is against the terms of service and whatnot, not something that is deciding what is true and what is false.
Right.
As a result, it's very easy for them to say, okay, this is a thing that is against our terms of service, even if it ends up being, you know, a weird contradictory thing. Like some of the things that Facebook has in their terms of service about racism make it so that you can make some really weirdly explicit racist statements without violating their terms of service. But certain other things that are not racist at all in our context get flagged as inappropriate.
Right. So like so on the Twitter side, I guess I would say I would agree with doing something about the shooting starts tweet, but you almost have to leave the voter fraud one alone because one is determining truthiness, one is trying to acknowledge that something could lead to actual action.
Let me play devil's advocate real quickly, because you don't use Twitter, or do you look at Twitter at all, Travis?
Yeah. Since Facebook is now effectively blocked at work, it comes up as just a white screen. I actually check Twitter every day instead.
Okay.
I don't have a very wide thing that I follow, so I'm not getting probably a broad swath of news from it. But
yeah, it's tough because you get from Twitter pretty much like what you put in terms of who you follow and everything. And I don't follow any of these types of people, but I do sometimes look at the topics in terms of what the trending hashtags and what people are saying, and usually get a lot of blue check marks. And I feel like if Twitter was going to be objective about it, I think almost every liberal comedian would be banned from Facebook, or I'm sorry, from Twitter, if we have this glorification of violence thing, because almost all of them are routinely like tweeting some stuff out about like, hell, we know, like, hope Trump decides to inject himself with bleach and try out his theories, or yeah. You know, it's,
well, I get, but
it's,
I guess,
borderline, but it's,
I guess, kinda... I treat the looting, I should really have remembered what the actual quote was, but like, yeah,
when
I guess
looting starts, a shooting starts, or something.
I guess
like that.
I treat that one differently because there's historical context behind that specific phrase.
Mm.
It wasn't, yeah, just, I mean, like, that was a calculated use of that phrase.
I always struggle to agree now, with the terms calculated with Donald Trump.
Well, I was just about to say, now whether he actually knew that was a thing or not, I don't know, but
he heard it somewhere and decided it sounded fun. No, I see what you're saying, but to me, it's a slippery slope when you start trying to like read into people's mindset and mm-hmm. saying, oh, this was a term that, like, it's like the chink in the armor thing, you know, from way back when Jeremy Lin had like that great stretch of games, and then they finally lost, and some guy wrote the headline, there's a chink in the armor.
I was just about to semi call you out of like, oh, there you go, using chink, but okay. Yeah, that, no, was, but the, that, actual, that was the point thing, like, yeah,
as far as anybody could tell, the guy had absolutely no idea he was using some sort of racial epithet there, like, yeah. It was just, it's a thing, chink in the armor.
One, we've covered that before about people doing things that aren't no one in their culture, but is offensive in another culture. So
yeah, like the slanty eyes from the South American baseball players. Even today, I think the Sacramento Kings fired one of their announcers because someone said, like, hey, what do you think of the Black Lives Matter? And he's like, oh, you know, I think all lives matter. And maybe you don't believe him. Maybe he's secretly a racist or a white supremacist or whatever, but he seemed genuinely contrite. Like, I had no idea that was, like, the wrong thing to say. And I'm not trying to take sides here. I'm just saying it seems tough to trying to get into people's mindsets about, like, oh, that was a calculated statement about of violence there, that it's part of the reason why I really hate that Twitter's going down this path, yeah. Because I think they're gonna end up just pissing off everybody, and no one's gonna be happy about it.
And I still don't think that they should take it down or anything like that. Like, I guess I'm just saying, like, I can see the difference between the two different things, of one is kind of might be, and that's the problem, right? Is intent. Like, mm-hmm. It might be meant to incite violence, or it could be some twisted commentary, like, just...
And the sad thing is, I think it probably was meant to incite violence, and yet at the same time, I'm not defending it, but I guess I'm uncomfortable with Twitter's decision to even label it, just because I feel like that's just going to lead them to have to label a lot of stuff.
Well, right,
unnecessarily in the future.
Anytime somebody says "go fuck yourself," you're going to have to be like, "Oh, well, we got to take that down now because they're trying to incite something." Like, if depending how far down that slope you slide, right?
Mm-hmm. Well, exactly. Well,
you could take that example that I actually saw off of Twitter. Not that I follow Twitter either, but I'm culturally aware. So one of the Wachowskis ended up posting a "fuck you" to Ivanka Trump because of the red pill meme.
Mm, yeah.
So, you know, a very reasonable position for the filmmaker to take about the content of her film being misappropriated for something completely unrelated that she disagrees with vehemently. Understandable. And yet still, you know, potentially problematic now. You know, is that a thing that we're... What level do we want our discourse to be at? Drink again. Okay. Like I said, I'm going to say discourse a lot here. I
think I'm already out.
I want to take this back around to the very beginning, where I was talking about Section 230 and the platforms versus the publishers. When Facebook, less so, and now Twitter are making these editorial judgments about what can and cannot be said, especially for something like Twitter with its truthiness, detector and say, okay, this is a problem for us because we don't want the president to spread mistruth or untruth on our platform, you're no longer really a platform. They are taking editorial control over it, which means they are the publisher. And that means they are going to be and should be held subject to higher standards. And I think that's one of the things that they are struggling with, because they don't know how to do that. Because, yes, they could hire a lot more people, more lawyers, more fact checkers, more editorial content supervisors to ensure that various tweets that are going out meet their standards and meet standards for publication. But when it's the end user posting it, it is a much, much different thing. You know, when it's just some guy on the street providing you the content that you don't read and sign off on before it gets posted somewhere. When, you know, I think a lot of this comes down to the speed of the internet. When you post it on the internet, or Donald Trump tweets, it's instantaneous. It's seen by millions of people in a matter of seconds. Whereas the New York Times publishing it, there was this process where they thought about it, and then somebody wrote it, and then it was checked and then edited, and then finally it was put onto print, and it was delivered to the person the next day. Right, so that's a time process. The time process for our response is also very, very slow, because our typical response to something like hate speech that we want to say, okay, you're not allowed to say that, is the police get involved, they make an investigation, they say, yep, we have enough to have probable cause, we're going to arrest this guy, and he's brought to the courthouse, he's arraigned, and then the trial starts weeks later. It's a slow process because it moves in meat space. The internet is doing all this instant speed.
Hate speech, correct me if I'm wrong, not a crime, right? You can't involve the I know people like to talk like it's a crime, and they like to
I was using that as a specific example of a thing that people are complaining about. Mm-hmm. But you can have a guy in Times Square mouthing off, stating his political opinions, and then he says something, and they can arrest him for that if they get to the right things. And it could be for, you know, inciting violence, it could be for
something the peace, a wide right? range. Disrupting the peace isn't that the catch-all whenever the cops want to arrest you and they don't have something.
Right. Eventually, they'll say, okay, that's enough of this. You've had your 15 minutes. Come along.
Yeah.
And it's also the scope factor. If you're doing this in the public square, the town square, you're being heard by 100, 1,000, 10,000 people, maybe. But again, the internet, especially if it stays up for any length of time, it's accessible to billions of people. Now, not all of them can understand it or read it necessarily, but still, millions or hundreds of millions of people can see this. So as a question of scope, the internet is very different from these things. And I do think we're in a situation where the laws and our methodologies for dealing with some of these problems haven't evolved. And that worries me, because where we are culturally, where we are politically, is not a place where we can build new mechanisms for dealing with this that I think are going to be effective and just and acceptable.
Twitter wishes that their stuff was seen by billions of people. I don't think they had that reach quite yet. Facebook, yes. Courtesy of Instagram and everything else, but I'm not sure with Twitter.
Yeah, it's also a theoretical thing. If I put up a website, it's, you know, if I put a blog onto Rampant Discourse, billions of people could access it.
That's cute that you think the billions of people would access it.
Of course they don't, but they could. If I write something incendiary, it could be seen by anyone. Now, one of the benefits of the town square thing is you can get up in people's faces, and that will get you arrested. But at least, you know, if they're in your earshot range, they're going to hear some of it. Whereas if I post a blog onto Rampant Discourse, or more accurately onto my own website at this point, then no one's going to see it. On Rampant Discourse, I will get a few viewers, and I'm happy for that. But we're not, you know, thousands upon tens of thousands of viewers. We're a small organization, and I'm happy about that. But at the end of the day, that impact is reduced. When our impact is reduced, then it's a lot less harmful. When President Trump says these things, it's not just harmful because it's something bad that he's saying. It's an incitement to violence. But it's an incitement to violence seen by millions of people, right? If he were just some schmuck saying this, it would not be as big of a deal.
So what I'm hearing is that we need to write more insightful stuff on Rampant Discourse, or talk about more
incendiary.
Insightful is not the right word. Incendiary.
You'd have to spell it for people to understand that version of insightful.
Yes, insightful and insightful stuff on the podcast. I do have a little bit of a gotcha question, Andrew. Do you still support Donald J. Trump nationalizing Facebook at this point.
Yes.
Because that was your position.
Well, my position was that Facebook should be nationalized.
Yeah, by the government. Obviously,
by the government, our government, U.S. government, yeah. Which is, you know, led by President Trump. You know, I would say things are progressing as I expected.
You don't say whether that's a good thing or not.
Well, I never said that nationalizing Facebook was a good thing. I said it was the best alternative out of a series of bad ones, right? Because I do agree that nationalizing things is, generally speaking, terrible. It's just that Facebook's situation is so bad that that is the best alternative.
So wrong. Still your worst take, even above your Robin Hood Prince of Thieves take. All right, well, that's pretty much all I have. Do you guys have anything else to add? Anything insightful or insightful?
I'll reiterate my point. Sorry, Travis. I'll reiterate my point, which is that the problem with social media is not so much the nature of social media, but the nature of people. People.
I don't know. You were going to say the problem with social media is the people.
Right. You have people that are, you know, getting into their bubbles and not thinking critically, and therefore getting worked up over stuff that they shouldn't be being worked up about. Getting worked up about the wrong stuff, they're missing the stuff that they should be worried about, and they're not exercising their critical thinking faculties to say, okay, yeah, maybe I shouldn't take this unproven treatment, especially if I don't have any symptoms of the disease, right?
Maybe an aquarium cleaner is not the right thing to inject into my bloodstream.
Exactly. But that does require that level of critical thinking, and some people clearly just don't have it, and that's very disappointing. Because I think everyone is capable of it. They're taking shortcuts that they shouldn't be taking, and they're being fed that's okay by the culture at large. So when people do this, it's bad, and I don't want to blame them further for their mistakes. But ultimately, I do have to say, that was really fucking stupid, guys. What made you think that was a good idea? Why didn't you think it through? And ultimately, you have some responsibility in each of these decisions that you're making along the way, even when you're being led to do a thing because the people in charge are telling you that it's a good idea, or it's the safest idea, it's the best way to treat this. That could be 100% right, but just because it's maybe the best way to treat it doesn't mean it's the right thing for you to do in this case.
Yeah, that was a pretty good attempt at being insightful, for, you know, calling people idiots. I approve.
Well, he just said that their response is going to be, I was just following orders. To bring the Nazis to bring in the Nazi reference finally at the end.
Yeah. Everybody needs their own Milgram device.
that's the next feature in Google Meets 2.0, the ability to remotely shock people. And, I'm not sure where it goes from there. All right, well that sounds like a good way to tie it up, remotely shocking people over the internet. I think we've reached the logical end of this discussion. Follow us at Rampant Disc on Twitter. Speaking of Twitter, we also have a Facebook page, facebook.com/rampantdiscourse. Check it out before it gets nationalized. We have a Discord channel at discord.io/rampantdiscourse. And we also have our website, which is protected by Section 230 at rampantdiscourse.com. So you can post whatever you want in the comment section. We're not responsible. Am I right there, Chief Legal Officer Andrew Riley?
We're not responsible, but if you post something that is illegal, I will take it down.
Hmm. There you go.
Assuming I see it. Assuming I see it.
Which he will not. I can almost guarantee you. But I'll point it out to him, and then he might take it down. All right. Well, thank you, gents, for joining me. You can't stop the discourse. Drink.